You know that symbol, the three golden balls? You see it on high street sometimes.
Very distinctive.
Yeah, most of us recognize it. But have you ever really, you know, stopped to think about the history packed into that sign? It's actually way more ancient and influential than it looks.
It really is.
So today we're taking a deep dive. We're looking into the, well, fascinating, ancient, and often surprisingly relevant world of pawnbroking and collateral loans, too.
Yeah, this isn't just some quaint historical footnote.
Not at all.
It's really a foundational piece of finance. It's been quietly shaping economies for, well, millennia, connecting dots across different empires, different eras. Our sources show this incredibly rich history stretching back over 3,000 years.
Wow.
So we're going to trace its origins, which are pretty surprising, actually. Look at its role in financing. Well, everyone from royalty down to the everyday person and its sort of unexpected religious connections, and then how it still functions today as a vital financial tool.
Yeah.
Our mission really is to unpack that whole journey of collateral lending, explore how it works, the mechanics, and finally, maybe solve the mystery of those three golden balls.
Okay, so this isn't just history for history's sake, then.
No, definitely not.
It's more about exploring how humans created systems for, like value exchange and trust, offering a unique way to understand financial ideas that are still very relevant to you listening right now.
Exactly. Relevant to your everyday life, your economic choices today.
Okay, so 3,000 years. That's a huge span of time. Where does this incredible story of lending and pledging actually begin?
It is an astonishing timeline, isn't it? The earliest recorded examples we have, they trace back to the 5th century in China.
China, really?
Yeah, specifically within Buddhist monasteries. These weren't just places of worship. The monks there basically operated what we'd recognize as early pawn shops.
Huh. Monks as pawnbrokers.
Strange combination, maybe, but they provided really crucial short-term credit, you know, to low-paid workers,
right,
peasants, filling a huge gap in the financial system back then. And what's really interesting is that some of these were like joint ventures, the monasteries working with wealthy private individuals.
Why would they do that?
Well, probably to cleverly take advantage of the monastery's tax exemptions.
Oh, makes sense.
And while these are the earliest documented cases, it's, well, it's entirely possible, even likely, that earlier forms existed, unrecorded ones, just driven by basic human need.
Okay, so from Buddhist monasteries in ancient Asia, that's quite a start. It seems like this idea, leveraging assets for quick cash, just had to spread, right?
Yeah.
How did it get across to Europe?
It moved remarkably quickly, actually. Pawnbroking soon became a pretty familiar sight in ancient Greece.
Okay.
And then later, of course, in the Roman Empire. In fact, the word itself, pawn, its linguistic roots are right there.
Okay.
It comes from the Latin word patinum, which means to pledge.
Patinum. Okay.
Yeah. So that etymology alone tells you how sort of deeply ingrained the whole concept became in their society.
That Roman connection is fascinating. With something so central to people's lives, did they start putting up some rules, some kind of legal framework back then? Because it feels like something that would need structure pretty fast.
Absolutely. And the foundations for a lot of modern laws governing pawnbroking, they actually have their roots in ancient Roman law.
No kidding.
Well, not copied exactly, of course, they've evolved. But crucially, the Romans had really strict legal prohibitions on what could not be used as collateral.
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Things like basic clothing, furniture, farming equipment, those were explicitly off limits.
Which is completely different from today, where you could pawn an antique chair or something.
Exactly. A stark contrast. You know, today, antique furniture, even a luxury handbag, could be perfectly fine as a pledge.
So that early Roman rule, it wasn't just a random law.
Not at all. It's actually an early example of a core financial principle. Selecting collateral is about managing risk and liquidity, making sure you can actually get value back if needed. That's a lesson still central to basically every loan application today.
Right, managing risk. So beyond those early legal codes, religion obviously played a huge role in how people thought about money and lending back then, didn't it? Feels like that's where a lot of the ethical questions came in.
It certainly did, and it brought up some profound ethical debates. Historically, you had strong prohibitions against charging interest on loans, what was known everywhere as usury.
Usury.
That was true under both Judaism and Christianity. In Judaism, charging interest to fellow Jews was seen as one of the worst sins. It's mentioned in the Old Testament, Book of Ezekiel.
Okay.
The Torah and Talmud really encouraged interest-free lending between Jews. But, and this is an important nuance, interest-bearing loans by Jews to non-Jews, that was actually not forbidden.
Ah, okay. So there was a distinction there. What about Christianity?
Similarly, Christians were also forbidden from providing interest-bearing loans and cash advances for a long time, pretty much right up until the Protestant Reformation.
But did people stick to that?
Well, despite the biblical rules, practicality often kind of won out. There were many cases where it was ignored or, you know, exceptions were made.
Like what?
For example, even the Franciscan Church was permitted to practice usury specifically to help the poor, recognizing the community's financial needs.
Right.
What's fascinating is seeing how these deeply held ethical and religious views influence things, but also how sometimes, just out of sheer necessity, they were kind of circumvented by the practicalities of needing money.
Yeah.
It really shows that constant tension, you know, between moral ideals and economic reality throughout history. It's a theme that keeps coming up.
It really is fascinating how those deep historical roots still echo today. Okay, so we've navigated ancient laws, religious ethics.
Okay.
The stage was set for pawnbroking to really take hold and evolve across medieval Europe. This seems like a big turning point. How did that happen?
Yeah, building on those ancient foundations and all those ethical debates around interest, the practice really started reshaping Europe in the medieval period, particularly with something called the mont de piété.
Mont de piété. What were they?
They were a specific type of basic pawnbroking set up by Roman popes, actually, with a pretty noble goal, lending money to the poor.
Oh, so like a charity.
Exactly. And crucially, these loans were initially interest-free. The value was just covered by pledges, you know, like clothing or basic equipment.
Okay, but how did that work long term?
Right.
Running a charity costs money.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Sustaining that purely on charity without any income, it proved impossible.
Right.
These original places, they cost money to operate. You needed staff, security, buildings, and they didn't make any profit.
So they had to adapt.
They did. It became more and more common to start charging a small amount of interest on the loans, just enough to cover those essential operational costs and expenses.
So it wasn't about huge profits initially, just sustainability.
Pretty much. And this evolution, it really highlights a core financial insight, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even systems born from pure charity eventually run into the basic economics of sustainability. Without covering costs, even the best intentions can falter. It just underlines that fundamental need for a viable business model in lending, even back then.
So this shift from pure charity to a more sustainable interest-bearing model, that must have really boosted its spread, right? How did that affect things across the continent?
Precisely. This evolved model meant these pawn shops could actually sustain themselves. They were meeting a clear need in the market, and so they began to spread all throughout Europe, starting from those humble roots in Italy.
So the model worked.
It proved really robust. By 1622, you had these pawn shops firmly established in major cities like Ghent, Amsterdam, Brussels.
Wow.
And most other major European cities followed pretty soon after. It just became an essential part of the urban landscape.
Okay, so when we picture a pawn shop now, there's that one symbol that always comes to mind, the three golden balls. It's instantly recognizable. Where did that emblem come from? Are its origins clear?
Ah, the enduring mystery. Well, the development of collateral lending as we really know it today, it got a huge boost in medieval Italy, specifically from the incredibly influential merchants in the Lombardy region.
Lombardy.
Yeah. And many of these merchants were directly linked to the, well, the incredibly wealthy Medici family.
Medici, yeah.
They are widely credited not just with helping spread the practice across Europe, but crucially with creating that symbol.
So the Medici created the three balls.
Well, it's believed that originally it was actually three golden coins hung outside their shops as a really direct, recognizable sign of their trade. Money lending, banking.
Coins make sense.
But this practice, while spreading, it did face some controversy initially, especially given those historical views on usury we talked about.
Right.
However, Pope Leo X, he made a really significant declaration in the 16th century.
What did he say?
He basically deemed pawnbroking a legally recognized and ethical profession across all of Catholic Europe.
Wow, a papal decree.
Exactly. And to make sure people took it seriously, anyone questioning its legality or morality could actually be excommunicated.
Seriously? Excommunicated? For questioning pawnbroking.
That's what the sources suggest. It was a powerful ruling, and it ensured pawnbroking became deeply embedded in European financial life for centuries.
Okay, so the Lombards and Medici were key. their legacy must still be visible today.
Absolutely. Pawnbrokers actually became known simply as Lombards throughout mainland Europe and the UK. And you still find Lombard streets or Lombard alleys in major cities all over the world. They signify the historical locations of these prominent pawn shops.
That's amazing.
So if you connect that to the bigger picture, the huge financial influence of the Medici family and Lombard banking, it made their symbol, those three balls, synonymous with the practice everywhere.
You mentioned the Medici's huge influence in making the symbol recognizable, but, you know, with such powerful families involved in lending, often to less fortunate people, were there concerns about exploitation? Did that kind of economic power come with risks?
That's a really crucial question, and it's a tension that's, well, always existed around lending, hasn't it? Especially when you have those power imbalances.
Sure.
While the Mondepiete started as charity, the Medici and other Lombard bankers were definitely commercial operations. Their influence certainly standardized the practice, made it respectable. But the potential for exploitation, for unfair practices, that was a constant worry. And it led to regulations, religious edicts trying to strike a balance between profit and fairness.
Right.
It's just a reminder, really, that financial power, no matter the era, always needs some checks and balances.
Definitely. Okay, so back to the symbol itself. You said it might have started as coins. Are there competing theories about the origin of the three balls?
There are indeed. Two popular theories, and both have pretty strong arguments.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first theory suggests, yeah, it started as three golden coins, a direct visual cue for their trade, but was later stylized into spheres, balls, simply to make it easier to see from a distance, you know, on busy medieval streets.
Makes practical sense. What's the other theory?
The second theory links it directly to the House of Medici's family crest. Their coat of arms contain a number of spheres, and specifically, the lowest three spheres on their crest are arranged in exactly the same triangular formation as the modern pawnbroking symbol.
Wow. Okay.
And given that the Medici Bank was, for a very long time, Europe's wealthiest and most respected financial institution, their influence on banking was just immense. It could easily have extended to popularizing a symbol derived from their own crest.
So we know it's Lombardi, we know it's Medici, but the exact coin versus crest detail is a bit fuzzy.
That's pretty much it. Historians can confidently trace the symbol back to medieval Lombardi and the Medici family, but the jury's kind of out on the finer details of exactly how it evolved into the three balls we see today.
Okay.
But its origins are definitely deeply rooted in the wealthy financial history of that Italian region, Lombardy.
That is a genuinely fascinating backstory for such an everyday symbol. So the practice takes hold across Europe. How did collateral lending make its way over to Britain and really start to flourish there?
Well, the basic concept, lending against an asset, probably arrived in Britain way back during the Norman invasion of 1066.
Okay, early days.
But its popularity, its real growth, that truly exploded with the later arrival of those very same Lombard merchants from Italy.
Ah, the Lombards again.
They brought their established, more sophisticated practices and, of course, their iconic symbol with them.
And were they just serving ordinary people or?
Oh, no. They weren't just catering to the common folk. They had some incredibly high-profile clients, especially during medieval times.
Like who?
Well, King Edward III famously pawned his crown jewels in 1388.
The crown jewels.
Yeah.
Seriously.
To finance his wars with France. Can you just imagine the royal treasurer trying to balance the books? Your Majesty, we seem to be short a crown and several large emeralds again.
Ah, that's incredible. Any other royals?
Oh, yes. Henry V also pawned royal artifacts for the exact same reason, funding wars.
Wow.
It really underlines the fact that even the most powerful figures weren't immune to basic financial pressures back then. It kind of gives a surprisingly human face to history, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Really paints a picture of its universal need, I suppose. But even with kings as clients, surely there was some pushback, some challenges for these foreign merchants setting up shop in Britain.
Oh, absolutely. The Lombard merchants, they often faced a fair bit of suspicion.
From who?
Both from the ruling classes and the common folk, which, you know, isn't entirely surprising when new financial practices arrive, especially foreign ones.
Sure.
But despite that suspicion, their services were just too valuable to ignore. Their popularity grew and grew until they became a really established, vital part of London's financial sector.
To the point where
it gave rise to Lombard Street in the city of London, a name that, you know, still exists today as a historic center of finance.
Amazing. So as it became more common part of the economy, did regulations start to appear in the UK?
Yes, naturally. As the practice became more widespread, integrated, rules followed. In the UK, pawnbrokers actually needed to get licensed from 1785 onwards.
Okay, licensing. Was it expensive? Were there rules on interest?
Yeah, the licenses cost £10 in London and £5 elsewhere, quite a bit of money back then. And yes, they set an allowable fixed interest rate, 0.5% per month.
0.5% a month.
And a maximum loan term of 1 year. This law actually worked pretty well for about 75 years.
Until
it was updated by the Pawnbroker's License Law of 1872. And that law introduced many of the regulations that still govern pawnbroking in the UK today.
So the foundations of the modern system were laid back then. Okay, let's fast forward. We've journeyed through millennia. Today, collateral loans aren't just history. They're widely accepted, even seeing a resurgence in some areas. How do they actually work now for people and businesses today?
Right. So in today's world, collateral is, well, precisely defined. It's an asset that helps a person or a business secure a loan.
And what kind of assets are we talking about?
It can range quite widely. Often luxury items like antiques, fine wine, classic cars, rare books, even, you know, high value designer handbags like a rare Hermes Birkin.
Okay.
The basic agreement is really straightforward. If you can't make your loan repayments, the lender has the right to take that collateral and sell it to get their money back.
And what are the benefits for the borrower, for you listening?
Well, pledging collateral can offer significant advantages if you need funds. It often increases your chances of getting a larger loan amount.
Right.
It definitely improves approval rates. And it can even help you secure a better interest rate.
Because the lender sees less risk.
Exactly. The asset reduces their potential loss if things go wrong.
So for someone thinking about this today, maybe for a big purchase or a business idea, what's the actual process, step by step?
Okay, the general process usually involves about 6 clear steps. First, obviously, choosing an item for collateral, something valuable that can be easily appraised.
Step 1.
Second, there's a professional valuation of those assets you want to pledge. Got to know what it's worth.
Right.
Third, based on that valuation, the lender makes a loan offer. Now, it's important to know this offer is usually less than the asset's full market value.
Why is that?
They often use what's called a loan-to-value ratio, or LTV, maybe up to 80%, sometimes less. Lenders apply these discounts to cover their risks, like the asset potentially losing value while they hold it, or the costs if they have to sell it.
Okay, makes sense. LTV. What's next?
Step 4 is your acceptance of the loan. A formal contract is drawn up spelling out all the terms, interest, repayment schedule, and your collateral is then taken into the lender's safe care.
Okay, they hold on to it.
5th is the loan period itself. You get the money, spend it as intended, and you meticulously follow that agreed repayment schedule.
And finally?
Finally, step 6, the end of the loan period. If you've paid everything back in full, your collateral is returned to you safe and sound. Or, if needed, you might be able to negotiate an extension, although that would usually come with additional fees or interest.
And this is different from, say, a credit card loan.
Very different. With unsecured loans like credit cards or personal loans without collateral, if you fail to pay, the lender's main options are damaging your credit rating or taking legal action.
Right.
It's also worth stressing, lenders generally prefer not to seize the collateral. Their main business is lending money, not becoming dealers in secondhand goods. The collateral is primarily their safety net.
Okay, that's clear. So beyond those high-end collectibles you mentioned, what kinds of assets can actually be used as collateral today? What's the practical range people might encounter?
Well, pretty much any asset that the lender agrees to accept and that's legally allowed. Generally, lenders like items that are simple to value, hold their price reasonably well, and can be turned into cash fairly easily if necessary.
Like what, for instance?
Common examples include real estate. Using your home equity is a big one. Automobiles, certain types of cash accounts, although usually not retirement accounts like pensions or 401ks, there are strict rules around those.
Yeah.
Investments like stocks or bonds. For businesses, it could be hardware, machinery, valuable collectibles and antiques, as we said, even certain insurance policies.
Insurance policies.
Yeah, some types with cash value. And businesses can sometimes use future customer payments, what they call receivables, money owed to them.
Right, accounts receivable.
Exactly. And in some cases, an individual might even pledge personal assets, like their family home, as a personal guarantee to secure a business loan for their company.
Wow, okay. That sounds risky. Are there warnings people need to be aware of?
Absolutely. There are crucial warnings. First, borrowers usually remain fully liable for the entire loan balance, even if the lender sells the collateral for less than what's owed.
Oh, so selling the asset doesn't automatically clear the debt?
Not necessarily. If there's a shortfall, you might still owe the difference. Second, if your pledged assets drop significantly in value during the loan term, say a classic car market crashes, the lender might require you to pledge additional assets to maintain the agreed loan-to-value ratio.
Right, a margin call, essentially.
Sort of, yeah. So it's a powerful tool, collateral lending, but it absolutely comes with serious responsibilities and potential downsides to understand.
It's really clear this isn't just for individuals needing a bit of short-term cash. What about the different types of collateral loans out there, especially in the business world?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Collateral loans are used for business financing probably just as often, if not more often, than for personal loans.
Why is that?
Well, money new businesses, especially startups, they often lack a proven financial track record. So lenders almost always require them to pledge collateral to secure that crucial early funding.
And that could include personal assets?
Yes, sometimes including the personal assets of the business owners, like their house, as we mentioned. It's called a personal guarantee.
Okay. Are there specific types of loans where the thing being bought is the collateral?
Yes, absolutely. That's very common. Think about premium finance life insurance. The policy itself secures the loan used to pay its premiums.
Right.
Or, much more commonly, buying a house. The property you're buying directly secures the mortgage loan. The house is the collateral.
Of course. And what about people with poor credit?
There are some collateral loans designed specifically for people with poor credit ratings. However, these often come with much higher interest rates and stricter terms. They should really be seen as a measure of last resort.
Good advice. Okay, so bringing this incredible journey all back to our listeners, What's the biggest, most profound takeaway from this deep dive into pawnbroking and collateral lending?
I think the biggest takeaway is just the sheer longevity and adaptability of this concept, pawnbroking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from its ancient beginnings in Chinese monasteries to financing English kings, fighting wars, navigating really complex religious rules, and then evolving into this sophisticated financial tool we still use today.
It's quite a story.
It really is. It's a testament to a fundamental human need for flexible credit and also the timeless, tangible value we place on our possessions, our stuff.
Yeah.
It's really a story of how financial innovation, driven by both necessity and opportunity, has shaped how humans interact for thousands of years. It reflects our constant search for solutions to economic challenges.
We really have journeyed through millennia here,
Connecting
dots from, you know, humble peasants needing a small loan right up to the incredibly powerful Medici family shaping European finance.
Mm-hmm.
From those early monastic practices to the high-end lenders maybe on Mayfair high streets today, It just shows how deeply financial innovation, those core principles of risk, value, trust, how they're woven into the very fabric of human history.
Beautifully put.
So next time you happen to see those three golden balls hanging outside a shop, maybe pause for just a second.
Yeah.
Consider the thousands of years of human ingenuity, economic necessity, that evolving sense of trust, even the conflict that they represent.
Yeah.
It truly makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other seemingly simple systems or symbols that are all around us today hold such a deep, intricate history just waiting for us to discover it?